Hello, and welcome to Polylog, a weekly dialogue on the substance and style of the Sunday morning political shows, where we take a critical look at the policymaker, the politician, and the journalist, because each is critical and each demands criticism. I'm Naomi Soto Steidel, your co-host and health policy professional based in California.
And I'm Brendan Steidel Soto, your other co-host and communication specialist in government, technology, and healthcare. Our goal for Polylog is to look at all sides of the Sunday morning talk shows.
We discuss guest performances, the style and quality of questions by the hosts, and the overall usefulness of the roundtable discussions.
Polylog is our attempt to find, praise, and demand constructive political dialogue.
We shared this in our last episode that came out on Wednesday, and that was the interview that we had with the Meet the Press team host Chuck Todd and the executive producer John Reese. But we're, in case you missed it, we wanted to share it just one more time. We launched a Patreon site.
Yes. It's very, very exciting. We've been making Polylog for over 18 months. We've learned a ton about the Sunday talk shows. If you've been listening, hopefully you've learned too. And we've learned even more about how to make a polished, worthwhile podcast.
And we do this, just the two of us, every Sunday. We watch the shows, we do the research, we record, and we edit to get a new episode in everyone's feed Monday morning.
Yeah, it's about 8 to 10 hours of work. We would love to be able to help fund the show, help fund more exciting episodes like we did with the Meet the Press crew, or to go to more political conferences, or even expand into other areas. You never know. We've certainly got some cool ideas.
Yeah, so if you like the show, we would so appreciate your support. Patreon's a site where you can support directly creators and artists.
Yeah, you can give like $1 a month. You can give like $5. It's kind of like Kickstarter, but on an ongoing basis.
Right,
and
that's
usually
a good way to put it.
With a lower dollar value.
Totally.
So it's like $1 a month, $3 a month, $5 a month, you know, small little bits.
Yeah, so we have three levels. We have kind of a tip jar at $1 or $2 a month. We have at $3 or more a month, you get the show agenda.
That's right. You get a rewards, not just
based off of how much you donate or
exactly.
Support on a monthly basis.
Yeah. And then at the $5 a month, you get a special segment.
An extra segment every Monday. So if you'd like to show your love and tell us that this show is valuable to you, you can support us at www.patreon.com/polylog.
Yeah, and you might want to go there anyway, even if you're not planning to support, because we got a fun little video that kind of gives you a backstage look at how Polylog is made.
Everyone should look at Brendan's video. It's a great little video.
So, on to the agenda. This will mark our second Election 2020 special. We did one a few weeks ago. Basically, what we've been seeing as the year has begun, we've been seeing lots of Democrats mostly announce that they're going to be running for president in 2020. It's a massive field of Democrats.
There's so many.
We also have some Republicans who are announcing or about to announce, which is kind of crazy, and we'll talk about that in this episode. But these interviews happen several times on different shows every week, and they're not always the newsiest of discussions. Sometimes they talk about the news, and we talk about that on our show. But what we've been doing is kind of
consolidating,
bringing them all together over multiple weeks when we haven't had a chance to talk about them in detail because there's been so much newsy stuff to talk about. But we don't want to throw them away. We want to look at them. We want to talk about them. And I think moving forwards, if we keep doing this, Naomi, it'll be kind of cool to be able to look through our podcast feed and say, oh, you know, Pete Buttigieg, he's doing amazingly. Has he been on the Sunday shows and how has he been doing? Well, you'll be able to look back and see, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, exciting stuff. We also have our ulterior motives as well. We have some family visiting this weekend. Actually, our adorable 11-year-old niece and awesome 14-year-old nephew, they're staying with us. And as much as I like to think that we're like the coolest tia and tio or coolest
aunt and uncle,
aunt and uncle, I don't think we're so cool that they're going to want to watch us make Polylog for 8 to 10 hours.
Yeah, on Sunday, on the one of the 4 days they're here. So
yeah.
Similar to what we did over the holidays, we're sharing these interesting moments with you.
With the 2020 candidates.
Exactly. So there's no highlight, lowlight this week. Let's just go straight into it. And I mean, I guess we could say it was a highlight to see on the episode on February 17th, Tom Perez, the DNC chair, and a discussion with Chuck Todd over just exactly how
The state of the party.
Yeah, how the party's going to deal with these 2020 candidates.
Totally. Yeah, one of the things that stood out to me about the interview with Tom Perez was that he wasn't trying to downplay the differences of the candidates or kind of the variation, but he saw that as a strength, especially given that in the broader umbrella, the candidates are kind of unified in what's important to them.
I want to put some headlines, recent headlines that sort of get at this new divide inside the Democratic Party, or at least a more exposed divide. USA Today, well, increasingly progressive Democratic Party becomes steadily more anti-Semitic, a reference to Congresswoman Omar's comments. The New Yorker, not exactly a conservative bastion, with the Green New Deal, Democrats present a radical proposition for combating climate change. Wall Street Journal, progressive Democrats claim victories. Amazon scraps New York plans. Are you concerned the perception of the Democratic Party is going to move too far to the left in order to scare away those swing voters that you won over to win control of the House?
Listen, I think we must never confuse unity and unanimity. We have unity on the fact that health care is a right for all and not a privilege for a few. Thanks to Democrats, we now have 90% coverage. We're having a conversation about how to get from 90% to 100%. They're talking about, on the Republican side, how to eliminate coverage for pre-existing conditions. We believe that climate change is real. It's not a hoax. And we're having a discussion about how we build this clean energy economy. The other side denies that climate change exists. So we're having a discussion about the means, but our values are the values that I believe command the respect of the vast majority of the American people.
So I thought this was an outstanding answer. We've seen over the past few weeks, Chuck Todd and the Meet the Press team, they're really interested in this question of the division within the Democratic Party. We talked about it on last week's episode. We talked about it a few weeks ago. They are interested to see how the Democratic Party and the Democratic electorate reacts to a division between very, very, very progressive, even those who call and identify themselves as socialists, with candidates who are a little more mainstream, middle of the road, more traditional Democratic folks. And I have not heard a better answer to that question than what Tom Perez says here about unity versus unanimity.
100%. I could not agree more. I think for so long, there has been all these kind of thought pieces of, you know, how is the party going to decide? Are they going to go centrist? Are they going to go further left? Or how, you know, like a sad puppy, a sad lost puppy or something, that the party had no direction. And Tom Perez is saying here, no, like, this is what makes us great.
Yeah. And I think he's also trying to downplay the divisions within the party. Yes, it might seem big to go from someone saying they're a socialist to someone saying we just need to, you know, lower the Medicare age to 50. But when he defines it by saying we already have coverage at 90%, we want to get it to 100, and we're debating ways to get there, that doesn't seem that...
That doesn't sound so bad.
Yeah. Oh, maybe there's a 10% difference. I mean, it's...
The ultimate goal is still the same.
Right.
Right.
It's a really, really smart answer. Not so much looking at the philosophies, which might be different, but looking at where people are going, you know, the particular policy agenda that each side is working on. Because maybe the trajectory of a socialist candidate and a more moderate candidate over the course of an entire presidential term would be very different. But with what they're talking about now, what they're proposing now, maybe isn't so different. I can just kind of see the graphs in my head here. But now the next question, I'm really excited to be talking about this, because I couldn't help but think about a very similar question we gave to Chuck Todd when we sat down with him in our interview. And that's the question of policing. How do you police folks who go off the deep end? And in this case, Chuck Todd is asking Tom Perez, what do you do about people who are running for president under the banner of the Democratic Party who color outside the lines in an outrageous, offensive, et cetera way? Here's how Tom Perez answered.
You've expressed your values. You've expressed your values as someone to say, hey, to the governor of Virginia and the lieutenant governor, and, you know, that these folks have to go. What happens when they don't respect the values? Congresswoman Omar seemed to accept criticism and apologize. But if she does it again, what happens when these Democrats sort of don't accept punishment, don't accept the fact that they're not representative of the Democratic values you espouse, and they don't leave, and they still want to represent the Democratic Party? What do you do?
Well, again, I'm heartened that Congresswoman Omar apologized because what she said was wrong and it was divisive. And
do you believe she's anti-Semitic? Are you worried that she is?
What she said was wrong and what she said was divisive. And I think Speaker Pelosi and others, including us, I think appropriately called her out. And what we have to do, and the difference between Democrats and Republicans is when we see people within our own ranks do things or say things that are antithetical to our values, we are not reluctant to call them out. On the other side, unfortunately, they are enablers.
What do you think of that answer, Naomi?
This is interesting because in my immediate reaction is, yes, the party should call things out. And if there's anything that we learned in the 2016 campaign is that the national parties did not call out bad behavior, bad trends, you know, just the direction of the campaign and saying like, hey, like, that's not what we want to represent. That's not what we want to fund. That's not what we want to support. And so I think being really clear about what you're willing to support with and what you're willing to call out is very important. But I do think what Tom Perez is saying here is really, it's important to make the distinction of what the Democratic Party is able to do and willing to do for comments that they find unacceptable. But to make the distinction that, like, yes, we're going to have members in the Democratic Party who are going to say the wrong thing, who are going to mess up. We're going to call it out when we feel like we need to. But in comparison, like, let's look at what the people on the other side of the aisle are saying and really remember that there haven't been too great on calling out bad behavior on the Republican side.
Yeah, I think the only problem I have is that he didn't exactly answer the question. The question wasn't, you know, what do you do when they apologize or what do you do when they do something wrong? It's what do you do when they don't apologize, when they stand their ground, when they continue to hold these horrible views or say these horrible things? What do you do then? And it's basically kind of the Northam question, right? Like, what do you do when Ralph Northam refuses to resign? Yeah, he's apologized, but he hasn't taken the action that everyone's called him out to do. So where do you draw the line? Or would you ask a candidate to kind of step down or step aside?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's behavior and views that is, you know, unacceptable behaviors and views, kind of like the Northam example. That's exactly what I'm thinking of. But I'm thinking of, like, 2016, Trump not releasing his tax returns. Like, that is right. What kind of stands out to me, where it's like, it's not necessarily views, it's blatantly disregarding the norms and rules. And they're saying like, well, he's ahead, we got to like deal with it. And so I'm curious as to kind of how much this quote unquote policing is going to stand firm when norms and assumptions are challenged.
Right. And they have more than just their voice. They have the power of the purse. They have the power of, like, organization. Like, you know, people that aren't going to be knocking on doors anymore. Like,
100%.
There is so much more they can do than just call people out on their words. And I think Tom Perez misses an opportunity here to say, if we call somebody out, they refuse to apologize, and it is that offensive, and they continue in that manner, then we have all the means necessary to remove support from them, and we will do so if they violate those norms and the values of our party. That is a total missed opportunity to say those words.
I mean, yes, I agree it was a missed opportunity. I think the severity of the moment with Congresswoman Omar maybe doesn't kind of... I could see it being a concern. It's like, well, let's match the reprimand to the moment, right?
Right.
And so that's kind of the only thinking.
Right, because it was specifically, Chuck Todd brought up that specific case.
Right, exactly.
And so I guess he probably didn't want to seem like he was saying, we're going to do this to you, right?
Right, right. But we'll see. You know, people are going to mess up more. We have a long way to go until the 2020 election. And so we'll see how both the DNC, but also the RNC respond to people.
Part of me felt like Tom Perez bringing up the distinction with Republicans was a little bit of like, hey, don't get mad at us. Look at what they do. They don't even call people out. You know, they're horrible, et cetera. It was a little bit of that. And that can seem kind of like an excuse for not going far enough. But I do think within the Democratic Party, there is value in reminding voters and Democrats and progressives, like, look, we can wear this as our badge of honor. We can be the you know, no tolerance party when it comes to this.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember that comment that Nancy Pelosi said. Do you remember? It was something about the Congress, a freshman Congresswoman apologized and the GOP ignored Congressman King for 13 years.
Right.
Something like that, right? Except sassier because it's Nancy Pelosi. So let's dive a little deeper with some of these interviews with the actual candidates, shall we?
Yes, and I brought up earlier Pete Buttigieg. We've been practicing his name.
America has been practicing his name.
He is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, but he's also a bit of an overachiever.
Such an overachiever, my goodness.
He is a veteran of the war in Afghanistan. He is a former Rhodes Scholar. He is the first openly gay man to run for president and the youngest mayor of South Bend, Indiana.
I need to get my act in order, get some more stuff done on my resume.
And he's 37 years old.
Probably out of time if I want to catch up to him.
Yeah, better hurry up.
But he was on State of the Union on February 10th, and his interview with Jake Tapper was actually really, really interesting for me. I'm never in Indiana. I'm not in the Midwest so much. I mean, I have like such a blind spot for state politicians in the Midwest. So it was really great to hear from him directly.
And they were talking about here climate change and the Democrats' newest proposal called the Green New Deal.
This plan calls for, quote, removing pollution and greenhouse gas emissions from manufacturing and industry as much as is technologically feasible with a 10-year outline. Obviously, something like that would completely overhaul industries across the Midwest, including in Indiana. Do you have any concerns about how the Green New Deal might affect your constituents or your state?
Well, like a lot of other things that have come along and impacted us in the industrial Midwest, trade comes to mind. We got to make sure this time around that it's done in a way that benefits us, that benefits workers more than it harms them. Look, there's always going to be change and disruption. As a town that grew up around the auto industry producing Studebakers until the 1960s, we know firsthand what those disruptions can mean. But there's also tremendous opportunity here. Look, we're not only being disrupted by economic change, we're being disrupted by climate change. We have had multiple cases, two different cases of floods, historic floods here in South Bend, of the kind that we're told to expect every 1,000 years or so, and they happened within 18 months of each other. So this is a national emergency, and I think the elegance from a policy perspective of the concept of the Green New Deal is it matches a sense of urgency about that problem of climate change with a sense of opportunity around what the solutions might represent.
This is super fascinating stuff because I think it's really important to have people from different parts of the country also talking about some of these newer, you know, to be frank, costly proposals that are being discussed by progressives because, you know, proposals like the Green New Deal, they're going to cost a lot of money and they're going to affect workers and they're going to affect certain industries. And so I think people like Mayor Buttigieg, like that perspective should help inform how the Green New Deal moves forward, evolves, and kind of gains reputation and influence, right? And what I appreciate him saying is that it's not something he's dismissive of. He's not saying like Indiana can't benefit from it, but we have to do it in a way where people like the residents in South Bend could be positively impacted by it.
Yeah, I thought this was really classically a successful way to frame it because he brought it back to his own experience and his own town saying, hey, you talk about this being disruptive, this Green New Deal being disruptive to industry. Well, industry is always disruptive. We've been disrupted here in our auto industry over the last few decades. There's always going to be disruption in industry, but there's also a lot of climate change that has disrupted our lives in serious, serious ways, like these floods. So why don't we try to tackle climate change in a thoughtful, intelligent way that can have some opportunities for us, but cognizant that, yes, there's going to be disruption one way or the other. It's a very thoughtful way to approach the answer. The only kind of question in my mind is if he keeps reminding people how local his government experience is, they might think, okay, yes, maybe we'll elect you as senator. You know what I mean? Like it.
Well, I mean, we're only choosing a few clips from this interview.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there were some questions. I think it was Tapper, or it might have been another instance when he was interviewed by George Stephanopoulos. But I'm almost positive it's this interview with Tapper, where Tapper asked him just that. You know, why? Like, how do you know? How do we know that you know what you're doing, or would know what you're doing on foreign policy issues? And he gave fantastic answers. And so I think, you know, we just don't know him, and he needs to kind of demonstrate his breadth for sure.
And he could do this exact same answer, not by using his own city, but using Detroit or using some other place in the country as an example. And maybe he'll be a very successful, you know, retail politician who can actually go to Iowa, go to New Hampshire, and use those places.
Wisconsin and right, Michigan, please.
Use those places as examples in his answers here.
And before we kind of go to another topic he talked about with Jake Tapper, we just wanted to also include this one question that Tapper asked specifically about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal proposal and where Buttigieg stood on it.
Which, again, it's important to note, wasn't just proposed by her, but also from Senator Edward Markey.
Do you endorse the Markey Ocasio-Cortez Green New Deal?
Yes, I think it's the right beginning. Look, it's a framework. Obviously, the Green New Deal, as we've seen it so far, is more of a plan than it is a fully articulated set of policies. But the idea that we need to race toward that goal, and that we should do it in a way that enhances the economic justice and the level of economic opportunity in our country, I believe that's exactly the right direction to be going in.
Yeah, and that's just like the perfect summary for us to remind ourselves, but also to, as a candidate, kind of a very smart move to say, this is not fully polished. This is not a set of proposal ideas for us to move forward on. This is a framework, and I'm supportive of the framework and supportive of the conversation that we need to have. And together, let's find something.
You know, what's funny is this Green New Deal truly is becoming kind of this base platform for the Democrats right now, in a way that other proposals, like the one Tom Steyer was trying to shop around kind of a few months ago for the Democrats, like, has not caught on, or the Better Deal. Remember the Better
Deal?
Oh,
God, yeah.
That was proposed. Just, you know, did not catch fire. But these kind of bigger ideas, bigger, more dramatic proposals are certainly all the rage in the Democratic Party. And a lot of people trace this kind of focus on big thinking, big proposals without all the details, right, to Bernie Sanders' campaign in 2016, which famously he ran as a socialist, and since then now has announced that he is running for president once again as a socialist and a Democrat, even though he's not technically a member of the Democratic Party. But speaking of socialism,
everyone's talking about socialism now.
You've said that young people don't see as much conflict between the concept of capitalism and the concept of socialism as past generations have seen. President Trump has been pretty clear that he's going to try to use the idea of socialism as a point of attack against Democrats. Take a listen to what he said at the State of the Union address.
Here in the United States, we are alarmed by the new calls to adopt socialism in our country. Tonight, we renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country.
Are you worried at all that that might be an effective attack against Democrats?
I think he's clinging to a rhetorical strategy that was very powerful when he was coming of age 50 years ago, but it's just a little bit different right now. I know if you grew up during that Cold War period, then you saw a time in politics when the word socialism could be used to end an argument. Today, I think a word like that is the beginning of a debate, not the end of a debate. Look, America is committed to democracy, and we are essentially a market-based economy. But you can no longer simply kill off a line of discussion about a policy by saying that it's socialist.
So, Brennan, we had a pretty long conversation about this on a hike recently. And one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot is just kind of how people at different ages and people who've lived in different places, how they react to the word socialist. And I think Buttigieg does a really good job here of making that distinction, that a significant part of the voting bloc does not feel the way President Trump feels, does not feel the same way baby boomers feel about the word socialism. And so He's not, it's interesting. He's, you know, he acknowledges that America is essentially a market-based economy because that's what it is. But at the same time, he's like, it almost feels like whether it's the politically smart choice or he genuinely believes it, like he doesn't have any incentive to demonize socialism, even if he himself has no inclination to identify as a socialist either.
Yeah, I agree. I think the distinction is really important to say, yes, we're a market-based economy, but we recognize that other social democracies around the world that are also market-based economies have services and take care of their citizens and try to create a fairer, juster country in a way that we don't, and maybe we could.
Which is something more nuanced than what we heard from Bernie Sanders during the 2016 campaign, to be frank. You know, he was very proud of his term, democratic socialist, but then, you know, had very little enthusiasm for any market-based solutions whatsoever. So it'd be interesting to see how far Buttigieg kind of walks this line.
Well, and I think it's interesting, too, Jake Tapper's question, because he brings in President Trump. And I really feel like President Trump he probably disagrees with Pete Buttigieg. He probably thinks socialism...
He being Tapper.
Trump. Oh. Trump probably disagrees with Buttigieg and thinks socialism really can kill off a line of discussion about a policy, just saying that it's socialist. Because we heard it in the State of the Union, and we actually saw it earlier this week when, just after Bernie Sanders announced he was running, he raised about $6 million in 24 hours. And then soon after, President Trump's campaign committee sent out a blast to all of its supporters, its giant email list, and said, Bernie Sanders raised $6 million with his socialist friends or, you know, whatever. You know, we have to crush that number. And they use the word crush that number. So I don't know. This is definitely something that you can see Trump gearing up for and getting excited about doing. And the only thing, you know, one of the things you said on that hike, Naomi, that I thought was very thoughtful is...
I said a lot of things that were very thoughtful.
I said one of them.
Okay. The one thing
that you said that was thoughtful. You said Democrats can get all of the stuff that they want policy-wise that they currently call socialism by simply calling it progressivism and not... Like, it's not worth it to fight for the word. Fight for the policy.
Right.
Like the word isn't important, and it can be misinterpreted by a generation of people who, by the way, vote more than anybody else, way more than young people. Like, yeah. Why are you going to fight for that word when they've got other connotations?
Yeah, and I think I was talking about a strong safety net is...
Right. A social safety net. You can mm-hmm. say a social safety net. You can say progressive policies. You can say social security, right?
Right, but the word itself, socialism, then becomes a bottleneck for robust discussion.
Right. It might not be worth the fight. And if you want to say, oh, well, socialism is kind of the cool, new, hip thing in the Democratic Party, it's like, well, actually, socialism is really freaking old. It's like centuries old. So if you want to have something new, maybe find a new word.
Yeah. That people don't have such intense feelings and reactions to.
Right.
And the last Democrat we want to highlight is Sherrod Brown. He is the Democratic senator from the state of Ohio. And we've talked about him on Polylog a bit before. He's kind of going around talking about his campaign, quote unquote, the dignity of work. And
which, again, isn't a campaign quite yet.
Right. No, I mean like a messaging campaign.
Right.
Not like I want to run for office because he hasn't acknowledged or announced it yet. But he's going to like Iowa and New Hampshire all the time and South Carolina. I mean...
Very popular vacation spots.
In January, Iowa. Okay. But anyway, he was on State of the Union, and Dana Bash had some interesting questions for him.
You just introduced a bill this past week that would allow Americans over 50 years old to buy into Medicare. But more than 20 million people are uninsured under the age of 50. So a lot of your colleagues, as you know, were supporting Medicare for All, a plan that would cover everyone. Why aren't you?
Well, I support universal coverage and have since I paid my own health insurance mm-hmm. when I first came to Congress. But I want to help people now. I mean, I want to expand Medicare to 50. We did that 10 years ago. We fell one vote short when Senator Lieberman changed his vote.
And what would your plan be in the short term to cover people under 50?
Well, you first of all, you go to Congress and you fix the problems with the Affordable Care Act. You stop the attacks that President Obama's made with the navigators. He's taken people. He's basically fired people that help people get on insurance that could get subsidized insurance and be in the exchanges that could get to Medicaid. Government needs an all in and helping people get on Medicaid. I think that if we, I go back and I want to help people now, and helping people now is building on the Affordable Care Act, not repealing Obamacare, which is what they suggest. It's making sure we fix the consumer protections for pre-existing conditions. It's all of those things. That will mean a lot more people almost immediately can get insurance.
Do you not think that Medicare for All is practical?
Wow, I was really surprised by this. I thought Sherrod Brown kind of really flubbed and unnecessarily dropped the ball here with this answer. We have literally been talking about healthcare since 2010. You should be able to have some concise talking points about the ways you want to improve our healthcare system. Like, talking about healthcare is not a surprise. It should be a given, and you should know how to answer that succinctly. And he doesn't here. It takes him forever to say he wants to increase access to Medicare for older Americans, and he wants to improve the framework of ACA for younger Americans.
Yeah, that's very simple. That's a simple answer.
Sherrod Brown, I'm not for hire, but you could take that for free.
Well, and maybe, maybe that's what he takes back, and messing up an answer in
this
February
early. I know.
Is not that, but that's why you go on the shows, right? To make sure that you can hone those messages.
I mean, I think I would be more sympathetic if you didn't know how you felt about the Green New Deal or about tariffs.
Yeah, something
or, you know what I mean? Like, come on, we've literally been talking about this for 10 years, and can we have like some agreement about what your stance is on this? Like, for goodness sake.
And it's also okay for him to say, when she says, what's your plan in the short term to cover people under 50? He could very well just say, we need to focus on those Americans who are more likely to be sick. That's those 50 and over. And we need to make priorities, and that's our priority. And then we'll move on when we can.
Yeah, nobody wants to say everyone is not my priority.
Right. Everyone and everything is my priority. I have a plan for everyone.
I'm very passionate
for everything.
About helping everyone on all things right now.
Immediately. Naomi 2020. That would not be your platform.
Oh my God, I'd have so many policy briefs. Are you kidding me?
Also in this conversation, Sherrod Brown shares information on something he calls his Patriot Corporation Act. And it's kind of an interesting proposal about ways that he can encourage, in his mind, more growth among manufacturing industries right here in America. Here's how he describes it.
My Patriot Corporation Act is simple. It simply says, if you throw out the Trump tax bill, the $1.5 trillion mostly giveaway to the richest people in this country and to huge corporations, that's fundamentally what it was. 70% of the benefits went to the top 1%. You then implement My Patriot Corporation Act simply says, if you play by the rules, you pay decent wages and benefits, you do your production in the United States, you get a lower tax rate. But if you're one of those companies, you big companies, executives making millions, but you pay a lot of your workers $10 and $12 and $15 mm-hmm. an hour, and they're eligible for food stamps and eligible for Medicaid and eligible for Section 8 housing, you levy on them a corporate freeloader fee. They reimburse taxpayers for the money that we as taxpayers spend subsidizing their employees. That will make a fairer tax system.
So this is, a very fascinating proposal. And it reminds me a little bit of, Naomi, if you remember when we were in high school, there were FCAT scores.
Nope, do you remember? Don't remember that.
Do you remember FCAT?
That's the state standardized test in Florida, right?
Yeah, the Florida Comprehensive Assessment Test. Ugh. And everybody had to take this test in 10th grade. And based on the scores of this test, the overall school itself received a grade level. If the students seemed to be learning and doing well, it would get an A. If the students weren't doing so well, the scores were rather low, the school itself, like Pine Ridge High School perhaps, would get a D. Do you remember what
level? Wow, way to call out our high school.
Do you remember?
Wow.
Well, we weren't, I don't think we were a D school. We were like a C. maybe? A B?
What and were maybe we? It became a D school. I feel bad.
But anyway.
A random school in Florida was not performing well.
Like putting a letter grade there, if it's just a grade, whatever. But the problem is that it was tied to how much money each school got, how much state funding. And it was like, oh, if you get an A, you're incentivized to keep getting A's. So you get more money if you get an A and less money if you get a D. And on the surface, that seems like, okay.
No, on the surface, it's a bad idea.
Hold on. But you can see how people would, at one glance, maybe think, oh, yeah, we need to reward good schools and encourage people to do good. And therefore,
teachers yes, to do yes, a good job.
Yes, exactly. The problem was that if you give schools that are failing less money, they're just going to keep failing only worse. Now, the reason I bring this logic up,
I mean, if we're going to put Florida on the spot, the other thing that was tied to it was if your school was performing poorly, I think an F or an a D for at least 2 or 3 years in a row, students could then opt out to go to another school. So not only would poor performing schools lose money because they were not doing well, then students would start fleeing and that school would have even less money. It was just like money draining out of essentially poor schools like crazy.
Right. And I guess the idea is that the schools die and the market succeeds and everyone ends up going to A schools.
Except those A schools don't want those like poor kids of color at their schools.
Right, which will bring down their scores. It's a very complicated thing.
I mean, this is also like 15 years ago, so we're not really exactly sure if this is still going on.
But I think the basic thing is, if something's failing, you don't give it less money. You have to invest more to fix it, right? It's kind of basic. The problem is that same kind of logic is kind of coming up here in Sherrod Brown's Patriot Corporation Act. He says, and there are people who are annoyed by this, right? There are big companies in the United States who make millions, you know, billions of dollars every year. You know, someone like Walmart, for instance, they pay the minimum wage and a lot of their workers end up having to be on food stamps or eligible for Medicaid, basically, or Section 8 housing, right? They don't make enough money in their jobs.
They're not making a living wage.
To live, right? They don't make a living wage. And so you could see the government being kind of annoyed, like, hey, stupid company, you're making billions of dollars, you're not paying your people enough, and we're having to pay them and give them all these benefits. That's not fair. You're getting the benefits of their work for less than it takes to keep them living, right? So you're going to be, in Sherrod Brown's Patriot Corporation Act, penalized, and you're going to have to pay a corporate freeloader fee. Well, what's happening there? The problem is, if you penalize a corporation for hiring low-wage, low-skilled jobs, generally defined by economists as low-wage, low-skilled jobs, you penalize them for hiring these people, then they're not going to hire those people. They're going to have a great incentive to automate those jobs completely out of existence or find ways to send those jobs to China or whatever. If you make it hard for companies to employ low-skilled workers, they're not going to employ them. That's kind of a reality here. So it's an interesting concept, an interesting idea. There's a whole chapter of it about it in a book I'm reading called The Once and Future Worker by Orrin Cass that I'm working my way through. I have not made it to that chapter yet, but I have heard some interviews. So perhaps I'll be updating this file one day.
Yeah, I have lots of skepticism of that. Mainly because I think companies, through their own business model, are incentivized to automate and to offshore as much as possible. And so I think any low-wage, low-skill jobs that could be automated will be automated. I don't think that there's like, I think that's going to happen anyway. And so, I don't know, I'm a little skeptical that if you make it easier to keep these jobs, that somehow these companies, by the goodness of their heart, are going to maintain those jobs.
Well, the interesting point that Orrin Cass makes in his proposal, which I've heard about, is that rather than charging the companies a fee, you pay a subsidy that goes directly to the worker.
Wait, hold on. Instead of the government charging the company a fee, the company pays
No. The government pays the worker. It goes into their paycheck to increase their wage.
So it's like a cash allowance.
Right.
I don't know. I would like to see his thoughts on other cash allowances then, if he's going to make this or if he's comfortable making this arrangement for corporations that make billions of dollars, and that's when he's okay with a cash allowance to low-skilled workers. Like, is Orrin Kass okay with, like, a universal basic income? My understanding of him, he's one that would clash to that. But yet, somehow, to make a company happy, he's like, just give people subsidies.
But I think the focus was not to make the company happy. It was to make sure that these workers stay employed. But I would encourage you to read chapter 9 of The Once and Future Worker called The Wage Subsidy. But it has like made me, whether I myself will end up supporting this proposal by Orrin Kass or not, I find it an interesting point that if you charge companies a fee for employing low-wage workers, they're going to be less incentivized to employ low-skilled workers.
I know, but do you see the underside to that? Is you're assuming they're going to want to keep those low-wage workers. I think I'm just more cynical than you, and I think the companies are going to get rid of them anyway.
But they might get rid of them in 10 years versus 2 years. Also, there's a lot of this book that talks about automation and how the fears of automation don't really show up in the data.
I know that. I know that there's some low-skill jobs that are not going to go to China no matter what, or aren't going to be automated no matter what. But I think there is a significant pool of workers that will lose their job. I think maybe we're making sweeping generalizations about low-wage workers, and for some people, this might greatly apply, and for some people, it might not. Like, I'm thinking, like, you're still going to need someone to hang the clothes on Walmart's, you know, clothing racks, right? Like, someone still needs to fill those in, but the warehouses where that puts the boxes together is going to be full of robots in like 5 to 7 years. You know what I mean? So like,
yeah, no, well, no, no.
That would be an instance where, like, in some instances, Walmart here would.
Yeah.
That would be another instance where Walmart will have to keep some low-skilled workers and in one part of their business, and in another part completely get rid of it.
Well, I think that's a much broader discussion. Maybe we'll have a special episode or segment discussing this book. We both read it and have a conversation.
Gosh, Polylog just consumes our life, Brendan. It can be more and more homework.
We can invite Orrin Kass onto the podcast.
Oh, that would be really cool, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, fine. That's cool.
Okay. And we'll invite Sherrod Brown on, and then they can have a debate, and we'll just sit back and listen. That'd be kind of cool.
We just told
Tom Perez
they need to police the conversation, and Chuck Todd needs to facilitate conversations. He can't take a step back.
I know. Well, as Naomi just said to me off mic, she thinks we're done with Sherrod Brown.
He hasn't announced yet. Maybe we'll do an include him in the next candidate roundup when he finally announces.
But now
we're done with the Democrats.
We're heating up those irons. We're ready to do some welding, I think.
Oh my gosh. We haven't been sleeping, okay?
Well, this will be our third episode we've recorded this week.
This week.
In like 3 days.
But Brendan's extremely corny dad joke is about Bill Weld.
So Bill Weld, he is a former Republican governor of Massachusetts and the 2016 Libertarian Party vice presidential candidate. He's also the first Republican to officially consider a primary challenge to President Trump.
And he was interviewed by Martha Raddatz on This Week.
Yeah, and Raddatz was supremely skeptical that he could do anything, make any progress.
Stood for anything.
Basically, she's saying,
get out of my studio.
Yeah.
So what is your path forward?
Well, I'm going to make clear that I think the president is reckless in spending. They're spending $1 trillion a year they don't have. That is going to crush Generation Xers and millennials in this country. They're not thinking ahead. 25% of the jobs in the country are about to disappear because of artificial intelligence and robotics and drones and machine learning and autonomous vehicles. Nobody's planning ahead for that, and it would entail a lot of work to make sure that the people who lose those jobs get the skill sets to get the replacement jobs when they show up at around the same time. If we don't do anything, then the door to the middle class is going to be shut on the working poor, which would be very bad for the country as a whole. That's the sort of thing they're not paying attention to in Washington because they're so busy with divisiveness and trying to make everyone feel awful.
They're just busy with trying to make everyone feel awful.
I mean, it truly does feel that way sometimes.
Yeah, and President Trump himself does seem to get Schadenfreude was a word kind of invented for him. It's like his greatest joy. Now, there you hear Weld bringing up the autonomy, Naomi. Maybe that's a platform you can stand behind. But it's an important point saying nobody's minding the ship for our long-term economic health. But Martha Raddatz, she's not buying it.
We talk about Republican support and approval among Republicans, but what do you say to the hardcore Trump supporters who think he's done a great job on national security, on the economy, on so many, and unlikely on the wall? What's the case you'll make?
He wants to divide the country and hold up, scary boogeymen that everyone else can think only he can save us. It's part of a plan, I think, on his part to make himself seem indispensable. He's not indispensable at all. People, getting through between the fences that are already on the border with Mexico are not a national emergency, and they're not a major national security threat to the United States. And I think everyone who studies the situation knows that. But it's pure rhetoric on his part without anything behind it.
Well, this will be a really interesting...
Did you say Welp or Weld?
Well. For Weld, this will be a very... No, for all of us, it will be a very interesting Republican primary if Weld kind of underestimates Trump's base. They haven't budged. They stick with Trump. So it's kind of interesting to think about a Republican challenger kind of saying, like, I'm not going to go for that 30% that are always going to be with Trump.
One thing that struck me, though, with hearing from former Governor Weld is this real sense of the emperor has no clothes. Like, here is a Republican standing up and saying all the stuff that everyone kind of knows or suspects or thinks about Donald Trump and just laying it out there and saying this guy is, he's dividing the country. He's trying to make himself seem indispensable, and he's not indispensable at all. Like, come on, people. Come on.
Yeah, maybe I'd feel more affinity for this if it was coming from, Senator Romney, who you're like, oh, the party really respects what you say. They are very deferential to you, and you're really calling it out. And you did that, or you've been doing it consistently. I think Weld is kind of has like a fringy aspect to him on the conservative side. And so it doesn't have weight in the same way.
Yeah, well, to that point, Martha Raddatz reminds Weld and educates the audience on just what that fringy sort of background entails.
The GOP chair from your home state of Massachusetts issued this statement after you announced, noting some of your past stances. And of course, you were a libertarian before and said you would be for life. And now you're Republican. Weld is the same ex-Republican who deserted Massachusetts for New York, who endorsed President Barack Obama over Senator McCain for president, who renounced the GOP for the Libertarian Party, who ran against the Trump-Pence Republican ticket while cozying up to Hillary Clinton. Even Benedict Arnold switched allegiances less often. So how do you convince that Republican base? I know what you're trying to do here this morning, but they see that record and think you stand for the party.
I'm not going to convince a Republican state chair because they're all under enormous pressure and orders from Washington. Make sure this guy gets no purchase. Make sure we don't really have a primary. We want to sail through this without anyone having to think or analyze issues. I think it's not what the country needs, to put it mildly.
So major kudos to Martha Raddatz and the This Week team for finding that very compact encapsulation of the type of mountain he's going to have to climb if he expects to convince anybody that he's going to be trustworthy with
principles. Yeah, especially given the GOP chair of his own state is not about him at all.
Yeah, it's just when he says he's going to be a libertarian for life, and now he's a Republican. And that was Raddatz, by the way. That was Raddatz saying that. And of course, what does he have to say to that? Nothing. He just kind of writes off the former GOP chair and moves on.
Yeah, so For the first potential primary against Trump, Weld is quite underwhelming. So hopefully there'll be some more formidable challenges to Trump. You know, there's been a lot of talk of Jeff Flake, which I doubt, but maybe Ben Sasse or John Kasich. We'll see if there's anyone that, you know, Trump feels intimidated or challenged or stunned by. But right now, I don't think Governor Weld is it.
But it could happen. But until then, or at least until next week, that is it for Polylog. We hope you've enjoyed this special 2020 episode, our second 2020 episode.
What are we calling these? Like 2020 roundups?
Ooh, maybe.
We're still workshopping that title.
Yes, we have to come up with a good title for these.
Maybe we'll have it by the
time. That's our dialogue challenge for ourselves.
Oh, okay. That's fair.
Come up with a good title. Or if you have a good title, you can email us at podcast@polylog.com. You can follow me at bstitle on Twitter.
And you can follow me at sotonaomi_, and you can follow the show at polylogcast.
Thanks, everyone, and we will talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.